Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Good morning. This is a Visegrad Insight podcast. My name is Adam Jasse. I'm deputy editor. And today I'm delighted to talk to Paul Taylor, who is a columnist and The Guardian, but he's much, much more. He's an old hand when it comes to covering European affairs, but also global affairs, a former Reuters correspondent and a think tanker as well. So, you know, it's a great honor to have you with us, Paul.
Thank you, Adam. And as a former colleague, it's a great delight to talk to you.
Paul, we just had an EU summit like many before. And as always, it's a bit difficult to discern what really happened there. There were some really important issues on the agenda, such as European defense, Ukraine, farmer protests, and the communique, as it always is very polite. It signals certain things, like, for example, the EU remains committed to boosting its role in improving Europe's defense industry and putting some money perhaps into it, but it's dressed in this language which is not really transparent. Could you help us decipher what really happened?
Well, Adam, I think firstly you have to remember the context of this, which is that we're at the beginning of a campaign for the European Parliament elections, and that therefore people are very much behaving out of electoral calculation and trying to brush sensitive subjects under the rug until afterwards, are signaling where they maybe have able to move after the elections but not before, are trying to appease certain electorates before we get to the ballot box, and trying to defuse protests that have been going on in the streets in France and Poland and elsewhere. So that was that's the big political context, and I think that explains why we had this rather strange summit. Everybody had expected it to be an overnighter with lots of rows. In fact, they went to bed, they put their curlers in by 11 o'clock in the evening, having not really agreed on anything, but not having violently disagreed either. And that's because, you know, everybody wants to, live to fight another day.
Right. But when we sort of drill down on one of the key topics, which is basically the EU role in helping the defense industry, European defense industry, obviously the need is there, the threat from Russia, the realization in Europe that they cannot count on American support if Donald Trump becomes president again. And there is this concept that the EU should be able to borrow money in the market and spend that money on defense. And there are a number of countries led by France which support the initiative. And there are also countries like the Dutch and also the Germans, I hear, who oppose this. The statement talks about the policies the EU can change to help the industry develop, defense industry. But the question of this borrowing was sort of swept under the carpet, as you said. Can it fly eventually after the European Parliament elections?
So I think there's a reasonable chance that some form of borrowing, collective borrowing, will fly after the European Parliament elections. It won't be easy. There are a variety of objections to it. There's the objection that it's, you know, more collective borrowing and it's all increasing the debt, and will it be constitutional? Will the German Constitutional Court uphold it or nullify it, as it's done with some of the government's own off-balance sheet borrowing, saying that it's a way of getting around the state budget? There are all sorts of constitutional issues. There are issues simply that the frugal countries who would provide most of the would do most of the repayment of any money borrowed because of their GDP size and so on, particularly the Germans, are worried about taking on more debt and don't think that the European Union shouldn't be living in debt. And then there are countries like Austria, Malta, Cyprus, which are neutral and therefore have concerns about you not using the European funds to buy buy weapons and so on. So there's a host of those issues. There are various possible ways that they could get round it. Either groups of countries could borrow collectively, if the EU as a whole is unable to, or else perhaps collective borrowing could be leveraged via the European Investment Bank. At present, the European Investment Bank statutes don't allow it to lend manufacturing of weapons of any sort. It does. There is a sort of bit of wiggle room there about dual use companies, and it's possible, you know, that dual use could be defined in a much more expansive way, so that something that was technology that was 90% of military use but 10% of civilian use could qualify for EIB lending. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the EIB could change its statutes. That only requires a simple majority vote of the shareholders and the capital in the bank, the shareholders being the finance ministers of the European Union countries. But that could be, nevertheless, politically quite sensitive. So there's a range of ways in which it could be done. I believe it will be done, simply because if you look at the challenges facing the European industry, for countries to reach and exceed 2% of GDP annual spending on defense, they're still going to need more money. And there is no history, really, of a war having been fought or even having been prepared for without going into debt and without financing it on credit. To give you just one example, the United Kingdom finally repaid its World War I debt sometime around 2011, you know, almost a century after the war. So there's a long history of borrowing in order to fund a military buildup, and that's what I think the EU is going to have to do. The other battle, which I think was very important and will continue to be central, is a tug of war between the EU institutions, the European Commission, and national governments. Defence is the most national, it's the core of national sovereignty. And among the biggest opponents or resistors, let's say, of any integrated European defense capabilities or joint borrowing, joint procurement, joint weapons development are the national armaments directors. They have their own long-standing relationships with their national industries. And this is why European defense is so fragmented, and why, although the EU collectively spends far more money on defense than Russia does, it gets so much less bang for its euro.
Right. But isn't that, in a sense, you know, making this whole EU-level attempt futile? A lot of time is going to be wasted on these discussions. In the meantime, the threat is real. So perhaps it would make more sense to concentrate these efforts on the national level, or, if you will, among countries that are ready to pull resources together and just place the orders.
Well, that's happening anyway to an extent, Adam. And of course, in the short term, countries are buying kit wherever it's available. Look at Poland, which is buying kit from South Korea, because they have stuff almost that you can buy off the shelf. Whereas, you know, it would take years to buy the same equipment if it were produced in Europe. So that's the short term. But in the medium to long term, the Europeans need to preserve, develop, and integrate their own defense industrial and technological base. Otherwise, they'll be out of the game, and they'll just be, you know, customers of, you know, and when you buy equipment abroad, it comes then with a whole schedule of maintenance that you have to buy. You're essentially buying other people's technology. You may be able to produce some of it in your own country. This is what's called offsets, but you still, you know, you're dependent on others. And if you do it with the United States, it comes with restrictions, not only restrictions about resale, but even restrictions about how you can use the technology. So, you know, to an extent, if you want to use some sophisticated American defense technology, you have to ask Washington for permission, even after you've borrowed and bought even after you've bought the system. So I don't think it's futile for the European Union to be pursuing these things. I just think it's going to take time. And in the meantime, urgent measures need to be taken to support Ukraine now. So, for example, the Czech initiative to source 800,000 rounds of artillery ammunition worldwide and try and buy it immediately and deliver it within months is a great idea. There's been some struggle between some countries like the Czechs and France, which says, well, you know, we ought to be buying European wherever possible. And if we spend too much money outside of Europe, then our own European industry will not be the beneficiary and will never have the defense industrial and technological base we need. That argument will continue, but I think that the EU will have to strike a balance.
Right. For the time being, the French apparently agreed to this time around to help purchase these shells abroad, but sort of long term or medium term, that's probably the view. Okay. Well, we started talking about Ukraine. The other big item on the summit's agenda was extending Ukraine's access to the European grain market or food market in general, and you know, there's growing opposition to unlimited access for Ukrainian grain and foodstuffs, mostly because of the collapse in grain prices, which is global. But it's sort of angered the farmers across the bloc, and this is particularly acute in Poland and in France as well. So, you know, what has happened there?
Well, that's another battle which is unfinished, actually. As we speak today, on Monday, the Belgian presidency was supposed to push through what was agreed at the summit, which was to roll over Ukraine's tariff-free access to the European market for a range of food production, which was done on what was going to be done was simply that they, as long as they didn't exceed certain thresholds based on past years, then it would be tariff-free. And after that, then countries could invoke safeguards. The problem with that is that they didn't agree or still haven't agreed on the reference years, and that France and Poland are fighting a rearguard action to include 2021, the year before the war, as one of the reference years. And if that was 2021, we imported far less agricultural produce from Ukraine than we did since the start of the war. And so that would reduce the thresholds, lower the thresholds at which these quotas would click in. So that's where the problem is. The Belgians decided to postpone that vote until Wednesday in order to allow more time for diplomacy. As you say, we've got farmers in the street or in revolt in France, in Poland. We've seen them also about slightly different issues in Germany. But everywhere, European farmers are under huge pressure, not only from Ukrainian imports, but also from the green regulations that have been introduced by the European Union so as to protect the environment and reduce the output of greenhouse gases and so on, fight climate change, which creates a range of problems, both paperwork and constraints that are damaging farmers' livelihoods. And this has become, once again, an election issue in the European Parliament elections. Conservative parties, but also the populist far right, have been making hay, if you'll excuse the pun, with the farmers' woes and trying to say, we're the farmers' friends, you know, vote for us because we will fight back against Brussels on behalf of the farmers, including parties like the European centre-right European People's Party, who are part of the coalition in the European Parliament that adopted these regulations in the first place. So we want to send the friendly signals to our farmers. We, you know, there's genuine concern about food production in the EU and the sustainability of the livelihood of farmers. The number of farmers has shrunk enormously in many European countries, and their children children are no longer willing to take on the farm when the farmers retire because of the difficulty of the work and the low income from it. And so these are genuine problems that Europe has. But also, we have to think about this, Adam. These are just the very beginnings of the issues we face if and when Ukraine becomes a member of the European Union. Because, you know, if we're fighting now in the streets over Ukraine's input for the over Ukrainian grain imports now, just imagine when it comes to fighting over their access to the benefits of the European Common Agricultural Policy.
So that is a harbinger of things to come once serious negotiations over Ukraine's EU entry begin. And again, you know, that seems to be one of the issues that was sort of swept under the carpet during the summit, or is it an exaggeration?
Well, once again, it's an issue that everybody didn't want to make a big fuss about before the elections. And, you know, I think that there's a degree of hype here, which we need to sort of slightly reconsider. Ukraine, if Ukraine joins the European Union, it will be in 10, 15, 20 years' time. And therefore, the question of whether the negotiating mandate to start to open the negotiations, which we've already agreed to hold for accession with Ukraine, is adopted before or after June doesn't seem to me a very big issue. But some people have made it a huge issue because they see any kind of delay as being backsliding in our support for Ukraine. I think that's unwise. I would ask those people whether they would prefer that the populists in the European Parliament elections could run an anti-Ukraine, Ukraine in the EU never campaign and make it more difficult and more politicized at a time when, you know, things are really just in the warm-up phase of these negotiations. So yes, I think there was a general understanding, perhaps some countries that are Ukraine's most outspoken supporters in the EU, such as Poland and the Baltic states, weren't happy about it. But there was a general understanding that it would be better to sort of take this offline for a few weeks and come up with this negotiating mandate after the elections, rather than give somebody the opportunity to turn this into a populist, top-thumping, anti-Ukrainian election issue.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for this. The last question. You know, I know you're not exactly a betting man, but given the things we just discussed, what's your feeling for the European Parliament elections? Is the mainstream going to hold the line, or are we indeed going to see a surge in far-right support?
Both. We will see a surge in far-right support. It will look horrible. The media will describe it as being an earthquake and that this is, you know, a massive disavowal of the EU. And then the mainstream will hold anyway. The centrist coalition, which has basically been in charge of European affairs for decades, will still have the votes in the European Parliament and a large majority of members of the incoming European Commission. I expect Ursula von der Leyen to be reappointed as President of the European Commission. I think that where it will be noisier in Parliament, as it became noisier in Parliament after the last elections 5 years ago, there will be more Eurosceptics there. But I think on the whole, what the French call the cordon sanitaire, you know, the sort of firewall between the centrist European, pro-European forces and the Eurosceptics, particularly on the far right, will hold. Maybe this time we'll need the votes of the Greens from time to time. They were not part of the coalition last time, although they did vote for some of the Green legislation in order to push to get Mrs. von der Leyen over the line. But I do believe it'll hold. There will be right-wing parties that will be tempted to, because of national politics, to make deals with the more the hard right, the more Eurosceptical. But you'll see people also coming in the other direction. For example, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, whose party is a member of the European Conservatives and Reformists, who are a Eurosceptical right-wing nationalist party, if she doesn't vote for von der Leyen and tell her members of the European Parliament to vote for von der Leyen as Commission President. She's been avoiding answering that question in domestic Italian politics so far. So I think that you'll see a bit of tug and war, a lot of sound and fury, but I expect that the dogs will bark and the caravan will go on its way.
Well, that's a perfect summary of this episode of our podcast. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Adam.